I am Conor MacLeod of the Clan MacLeod, and I am immortal.
Looking for a dead guy named Nash.
You talk funny, Nash. Where are you from?
Lots of different places.
I am Juan Sanchez Villalobos Ramirez, chief metallurgist to King Charles V of Spain.
Everybody's got their problems.
You're alive. Why didn't you die?
Hey, it's a kind of magic.
Hi, I'm Candy.
Of course you are.
Hello and welcome to Another Time MacLeod, the only podcast, to our knowledge, dedicated to exploring that wonderful 1986 cult classic Highlander, scene by scene. I'm your host, Rob Wallace, and as always, I'm joined by McKinsman, Mr. Rob Daniel.
And as always, it is a pleasure to be here.
And I'm delighted to say that today we are joined by first-time guest, Scott Varnum.
Hello.
Oh, hi, Scott. Welcome to Another Time MacLeod.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, before we dive in, would you like to tell us a bit about yourself?
Sure. Okay, I'm a writer. I've pretty much been that my entire life. I've written for Starburst, Den of Geek, things like that. I'm also currently, I'll plug this again later, but I'm running a Highlander Archive Twitter account, completely unofficially, but yeah, that's fine.
Oh, that explains, yes, because we've now being followed by that account on Twitter. I was wondering who was running it.
Yeah, there we go. Yes, I've got like 14 followers at the moment. It's really quite new.
No, it's great. You've been posting some really cool. Oh, there we go. Run by Scott V. Writer.
That's a new addition. I don't think that was there when I followed you.
But no, it's got some really, really useful, nice stuff on there. You've most recently some really nice photos of some of the swords and some of the costumes from the exhibit at the BFI back in 2018. Yeah, very cool.
Yeah, good. I mean, I basically, we could talk about that more if you want. It's basically just a product of trawling through auction sites and catalogs and things like that at like 3 o'clock in the morning.
That is a good use of Twitter. That is a good use of Twitter.
Yeah. Yeah, it's this kind of stuff. I get excited by seeing that sort of thing. So I thought other people might as well.
No, definitely.
I think there was a thing that you put up that was it the treatment or notes from the writers about what the prize is, which went up?
Yes, that was a memo that they sort of circulated during the making of the film to say, here's what exactly the prize is as we see it.
Yeah, that's a great post because, of course, that was something that was kind of added to the film a bit later to give it a goal and to give it like a big Hollywood climax.
Yeah, because, I mean, in the original script, it was literally just the Kurgan was trying to just end this thing and win the game. It wasn't necessarily, I mean, there was some energy clouds and whatnot. You get essentially a quickening, but it wasn't really a prize as such, I don't think.
That's right, yeah. And it's, yes, it was great to see that. So where did you find that?
That was something I remembered seeing a few years ago. It was most recently posted on the Highlander Facebook page, at the Instagram as well, I think, around 2017 or so. But before that, I think it was something that they'd released in a catalogue or a magazine or something like that, because it was the writers looking back at it 10 years on, so it was in 1995.
Oh, wow, brilliant. Yeah, it's well worth a look to anyone who's interested in just seeing the thought process that went around the film from the other writers that came on. Yeah, so Larry Ferguson, Peter Bellwood.
Yeah, it's fun to see exactly how explicit they are with it. There's very little room for interpretation. Like, the depth of the author has to apply or you are going to have a bad time.
Yeah, that's right.
And yeah, Scott, what was your first kind of experience? How did you come to Highlander?
So I think I first watched it when I was about 12, because I remember the DVD that my dad had still had a £3 from Asda sticker on it, so I can kind of like date it to roughly when it came out. I sort of put it on one day and it was like, this is it now. I'm transformed. This is like, I had a serious like obsession with it for a while. Still do, to, I mean, obviously to an extent, because otherwise, you know, I wouldn't run a Twitter account like that.
Yes, I think you're talking to two people who can very much connect with that.
Yes.
Yeah, very true. So I discovered, so then I progressed on to the other films in the quintilogy, I guess, either. I came to the TV series much later, because I'd done that thing of, like, the wiki was around by the time I got into it, so I sort of read everything on the wiki. I knew everything that happened before I started watching the TV series.
Well, so what were the elements of it? Because if you came to it on DVD, then there were a lot of other big fantasy movies that had better special effects and would have looked newer than that. So what was it about Highlander, this film from the 80s, that really caught your imagination at that time?
Sure. So I started with Star Wars when I was about 7, because that was when the special editions came out. And that obviously got me into like swords and, you know, lightsabers and things like that. So that was my entry point into, you know, you start off watching it for the swords and such, and then you find more in it as you grow older and you sort of start to resonate with it a bit more.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that was once I was into it, I got more on the immortality side of things as well. That sort of, that's still something that I think that fascinates me, the whole immortality side of it and, you know, wanting to live longer and things like that. That's a very big part of the fantasy for me.
Yeah, indeed. I think that's one of the clever things about the film, is that the older you get, if you liked the film as a kid, it will stay with you forever, because the older that you get, the more appealing the idea of immortality gets, and staying a 22-year-old man or whatever he is forever. It's like, as your knees start hurting and your back hurts, it's like, oh, that would be quite nice.
I mean, let's be honest, he wasn't 22. He looks 40.
Well, I think that's pretty a pretty good jumping in point. Today, we're going to be discussing the scene between 1 hour, 16 minutes and 36 seconds, 1:16:36. And 1 hour, 17 minutes and 48 seconds, 1:17:48, which is, the Kurgan's final appearance at the hotel.
Yeah, I didn't realize that until you said it, but yeah, of course he doesn't come back, does he?
No, and you don't get the sense that he's packed up his room.
No.
You know, he doesn't give him his keys back, he doesn't pay for whatever he's taken out of the minibar.
I can't believe that place would have a minibar, surely.
I think it would have a disused fridge that everyone just puts their stuff into and it all just gets nicked.
It does explain why everyone appears to be ill.
Oh, God. Yeah, we'll touch on that, I think.
Because, I mean, this scene follows off the back of the flashback to the duel on Boston Common with Bassett being shot in the back.
Hopkins.
No, sir.
And then we cut straight to a modern-day TV broadcast where the news anchor is clearly talking about the headhunter and, you know, New York sort of being under this pall of fear.
That's the mood of New York at this moment.
And it's interesting because there's like a Summer of Sam vibe to it. And watching that, it made me think there's an entirely different version of Highlander. We've said previously about how the cop narrative doesn't go anywhere, but there's an entirely different version of Highlander that could be told just from the perspective of the cops who think they're hunting this like Zodiac killer.
Oh yeah, that's a good way to go with it. That could be reboot maybe.
Yeah, I mean, that's I think there were things like that during the 80s. I think there was like a cop thing that would then become more of a fantasy as they realised what they stumbled into. And I suppose it doesn't quite fit, but Alien Nation is that kind of thing where a cop... No, but the aliens are already there, aren't they? But anyway, ignore me. But one thing, Rob, just so we don't get letters, Hotchkiss is the one that gets shot in the back.
Oh, yes.
I believe he gets shot in the bum. but yes.
Is this part of the test?
Yeah, that's right.
So yes, this is part of the test you've passed. You've I like to seed in errors throughout the podcast.
I didn't jump in and correct you.
And at the end, whoever spots the most gets a prize.
Gets the prize. Yeah, that's...
He gets the prize, there.
So that's...
Do you know those guys are at the London Film Fair, by the way, in June? So it's Hotchkiss and Bassett.
I did not.
Yeah, the 19th of June.
Oh.
Well, there you go. That's a bit of information for you.
You free that day, Rob? I'm up in Manchester, I'm afraid.
I'm probably not free. Well, I might be free in...
Oh, I'm sending my stuff in. I'm not going.
Yeah, I might be free in the afternoon. It's my sister's birthday that day, so I might be having brunch. So I may be free in the afternoon. But it's like, sorry, I'm going off to try and talk to Bassett and Hotchkiss.
Rob.
Sorry, I'm home to...
I can't think of anything that your sister would like more as a birthday present than to be taken along to meet
them. Than my not being there.
No, for you to take her along to meet them. Like these... two extras in that film that I keep just going on about.
And Billy Hartman's meant to be at next Comic-Con in July? It's in July. I tried to meet him at the last one, but unfortunately he dropped out. Yeah. So
yeah, that's the point. We were in the same room.
Yes, we were. We were in the same room and never realised till after the fact.
Yeah, I knew roughly what you looked like. I think it's on your Twitter. But I sort of didn't see you until I think we were sort of in the same quiz together.
Yes.
Wait. That sounds a lot more like we were actually hanging out. No, we were just in the same room as the quiz was going on.
And did you go to the? Sorry, this may get this may be edited slightly in the final version of the pod. But did you go to the Adrian Poole talk?
No. I think I'd sort of made a departure by that point. I can't really remember when that was during the day. That might have been the afternoon.
No, that was really interesting. Obviously, yeah, talking a lot about Highlander. Hmm. And did you know that he was originally meant to be playing Connor McLeod in the series?
I was gonna say not in the film, surely. Yeah, he didn't campaign for that, like to change it from Connor to his own character.
Yes, yeah, because he didn't want to follow Christopher Lambert, which is fair enough.
Understandable.
Apologies if any listeners have heard a car alarm, or can again now still hear a car alarm going on outside mine. You may not be able to.
I can't.
But it's all part of the wonderful atmosphere that we're bringing to this discussion, because obviously it's a pretty seedy hotel. So.
Yeah, just adding some special effects now, just some sound effects in the background.
Yeah.
Yeah. I do love how scuzzy it is and just how clearly run down. I mean, watching this, I thought, yeah, you could do a secret cinema, you know, on Highlander. You could have all the locations. But then I realised that, yeah, maybe apart from the Highlands, it's quite difficult to duplicate the Highlands. Basically, this scene, you know, then goes to the shot of the lift door opening and the camera pulling away as the Kurgan moves forward down the corridor. And we've got that random guy just leaning on the wall next to the lift, coughing.
Yeah. I can't remember. Is the Kurgan carrying his briefcase at this point?
I don't think he is.
Yeah.
I'll quickly bring up...
I know he can't be, can it? Because otherwise, how would he do what he does later with the clerk? Like, let me just put my case down and...
And that's the thing, because if he is, I don't think it's ever in shot.
Mm.
I mean, it's possible he's holding it in his left, because if he is, his left arm's always down. It's always out of shot, because he's always shot from... just above the waist.
Mm. Yeah, I'm trying to think.
And when he turns, he grabs the clerk with his right arm.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's possible he's carrying the case. You just never see it.
Mm. Yeah. It just occurred to me. It was like, I've never really thought about that before. But
yeah. So Scott, what did you think of this scene? And it is one of those things where for your first scene, we've given you a man walking down a corridor. So so go hog wild with that.
Mm. It kind of doesn't really serve much of a purpose, does it really? It's not really, it doesn't really need to be there. It's just punctuation.
Yeah.
But I think the only thing it does really is just show that he's a dude not to be messed with, which we already knew.
Yeah, I was hoping on the audio commentary that Russell Mulcahy would say something about the Terminator, because I think that the producers went after Arnold Schwarzenegger for the role of the Kurgan.
Yeah.
And this shot is just a lift from the Terminator. And there's a very, very similar shot in the Terminator. And even the music in this shot has that kind of do, 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 do there. And it's like...
Sorry, Rob, can you just do that once more?
I think this was... No. But you can loop it.
Fine, I'll just sample it again.
But it's one of those where it's like, at the time when I watched it with my family, we all went, it's the Terminator. And it was such a... That had been such a big film around that time that everyone just kind of knew that shot, the way that he's moving, the way that he's dressed. It's like, okay, yeah, so you are really going for a Terminator vibe with this one.
Yeah.
And the guys that he's passing, you know, in the hallway as he goes along, the guy that says, "Give us a drink, pal," sounds distinctly Scottish.
Give us a drink, pal.
Which is odd, as they filmed this in London. They filmed this at St. Olaf's Hospital in Bermondsey, which is about 15 minutes walk from where I am now.
Wow. Yeah, I'd never really clocked Scottish in his accent.
I didn't either. I thought...
Well, I'll listen for it now. Yeah. I will. I'll keep an ear out.
I mean, is it the same guy who asks for a joint immediately after? Because I thought those were two separate people.
Yeah, I think it's... No, I thought it was the same person.
I think it's the same, yeah.
Oh.
Give us a drink, pal. Got a joint?
Okay, so may just be my tin ear coming into effect. but interestingly, on St. Olaf's Hospital, it closed down in 1985 and has now been redeveloped into, I just think, a usual residential street, a place called Anne Moss Way. But its claim to fame is that Michael Caine was born there.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, the birthplace of perhaps the most famous living Londoner. Or the most iconic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's... So that's St. Olaf's Hospital. I'm not quite sure how authentically New York those circular alcoves look. The ones that they kind of pass through en route to the lobby. I mean, that's just my being very nitpicky. I've never stayed at like a roach motel in mid-1980s New York, so I can't really comment.
Well, that's something I've been enjoying with this podcast so far is that you guys like know about the locations and stuff like that, and that's like a real blind spot for me. Like, it's like, oh yeah, of course I didn't actually know that it was filmed in hospital in Bermondsey. Like, yeah, never really stumbled across that information.
Well, you know, I didn't until I started doing the research for this pod. I didn't realize that so much of it is local.
Yeah, and getting to that in the next episode, because yes, when I watched this in the 80s, it was like, it was an American movie. So everything was just American about it. And then when Rob said, do you know lots of it was shot in Bermondsey? It's like, no, I didn't know any of that. That's amazing. But there's, and the next episode, there's a particular scene that's like, looks very American until you find out it's shot in London.
Yes, we've got the Kurgan passing through the lobby, at which point the desk clerk, whose actor, Rob, remind me, he has a wonderful name.
Richard Bonehill.
Oh, can I just call out that, have you seen what the Kurgan is wearing on his jacket? He's got Ramirez's pearl earring on his, as a little feature on his jacket.
That's such a wonderful little detail, isn't it? And I did not notice that.
Yeah, it's Reddit, you know, detail, like movie details kind of thing I saw a while ago.
Did you notice that when you watched it?
No, I didn't notice it until it was pointed out to me. It's but actually, Richard Bonehill has his own Wikipedia page. Because even though in this it's quite a small supporting role, he was primarily a stuntman.
Wow, fair play to him.
He was a competitive fencer, and
yeah,
he won a whole bunch of awards, like. I mean, he's one of the fencers in Rob Roy. He's in Return of the Jedi and Flash Gordon and Empire Strikes Back. But pretty much every supporting actor in this film has been in a Star Wars.
But the thing is, do you know who he plays in Return of the Jedi? Well, he actually plays three different roles in Return of the Jedi. So he's a stormtrooper, Mon Calamari, and Neen Num, who co-pilots the Millennium Falcon with Lando Calrissian.
Falcon, yeah.
Let that shield down on time.
Wait, he's that guy?
He is Neen Num.
Wow. Well, yeah, I know exactly who he's talking about. Jesus, I didn't know that.
No, me neither until I looked him up. He plays Buck the hotel clerk, and for some reason it's not credited in the film, even though it's got quite a big talking part. Speaking role, sorry.
So it's Neen Num who says, "Hey Rockefeller, hope you liked candy. She said you were kinda kinky, huh?"
"Hey Rockefeller, how'd you like candy? She said you were kinda kinky, huh?"
Just the next time you're watching Return of the Jedi, just have that in your head.
Oh, God. Jesus.
But when he says that, when he says you're kind of kinky, huh? I'm guessing that all immortals probably are.
Suppose you have to be, yeah.
They've spent, like, you know, centuries of, yeah, exactly, like, of just, you know, sex and dysfunction. And also, if a prostitute is saying to the desk clerk, somebody's kinky, he must be really kinky.
Well, I think that might be because he was holding the sword as, well, so to speak, as she walked in.
I was going to note that. Yeah, I went back and rewatched that scene, which again is about 50 minutes earlier in the film at this point, and the fact that he's left the door unlocked.
Yeah, that's a very good point.
Sorry, Scott, when he said he's holding the sword, I was thinking, he's one of those guys that just holds the sword during the act itself as well. And
yeah, I regret that choice of words.
No.
So what do we think? What's the Kurgan's fetish?
Oh, God. Actually, I know one of them because it's in the novelization. He talks about scars.
Oh, go on.
Yes.
Tell us more about that.
Yeah, he basically, I was about to sort of start demonstrating visually, but of course we can't see each other. He has at one point in the past, previously been with a prostitute, who had, I think it was a nipple sliced off or something like that. And she was like sort of, you know, afraid to show him. And he sort of encouraged her to, you know, sort of, it sounds a bit more gentle than I think the Kurgan is known for being. And she finally shows him, he laughs at her, but then encourages her to laugh at his sort of body as well.
Wow.
Yeah, it's really weird.
I mean, I was just going to say BDSM, but no, that's way more interesting.
Yeah.
I was also sort of demonstrating the memory a bit too well there.
I wonder if that was in the original script, because a lot of times a novelization would be based on an earlier draft of the script.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is there anything else you can remember about the novelization? Because it's a hard book to find now.
Though I think for this scene, not so much, but definitely in the next episode, I've got a couple of observations about that.
Nice.
Oh, brilliant. Cool. Well, save it for that then.
And talking about scars, we get a really good look at the Kurgan's face in this scene with that kind of keloid scarring around his right eye. And we also get to... This is probably the best look we've had at his modern day costume so far.
Mm.
You know, the leather jacket with the chainmail elements. And apparently Clancy Brown really wound up the costume designer, Jim Ackerson, because he just kept picking bits of it off.
Yeah.
Basically had to be told, stop doing that. But then obviously, you know, he stops and he's got the incredibly gravelly, don't ever speak to me.
Oh, that was good in the headphones.
Don't ever speak to me.
That was good. That was. I think Rob's been practicing that one. And it was worth it.
Which, yeah, he just kind of stops and he says that because you expect him to just kind of walk out and ignore him. But, okay, in which case, if there is that element of, I don't know, tenderness in sex, or is that kind of connection, the way that he connects is, you know, comparing scars.
Mm.
Maybe Candy, like, just, you know, gossiping with the clerk and kind of writing it off as being kinky actually does get to him. Maybe there's a moment where he's like, I'm actually angry about this, and I'm going to take it out on the guy behind the desk.
Yeah, I never really thought about that, but yeah, that could be a perfect... That makes sense, actually.
Mm-hmm. Well, Clancy Brown wanted the Kurgan to be a deeper character, I think, didn't he, than what you could argue he is on screen, and had lots of other... ideas for the character. So so maybe that does tie into that kind of element of it that he feels that that moment has been cheapened, even though it was an encounter with a sex worker in a roach motel. But so Scott, what else did you take from this scene?
I mean, first of all, I do kind of understand where he's coming from. I've definitely had mornings like that when I've been living with people, like, just don't look at me. Don't just like, oh, God, I can't.
He hasn't had his coffee yet.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Maybe that's what it is. I'm sure I think. I like that the guy has a cold sore.
Yes. And it's such a... Yeah, so Buck the hotel clerk has a cold sore, and it's such a beauty, isn't it? I mean, it's a real... We get the idea that it's been there a while.
Yeah. He's just sort of living with it at this point. I love how lived in this makes the world feel. It's a kind of realistic scene almost. It's very sort of well put together as a set and extras and all that sort of stuff.
Mm.
Like the guy laughing, the drunkard,
Mr. Lucky Strike.
Mr. Lucky Strike. Yes, exactly. That guy.
That's right, Mr. Boomer. Lucky Strike means fine to butt.
He makes it feel, he's obviously sort of settled down there. Like, I like the don't talk to the guests that happens slightly earlier in the film. It just sort of makes it feel a lot more, like I say, a lot more realistic. Sort of gives it a texture.
Don't talk to the guests.
Yeah, his name is Prince Howell and he is credited. So,
that's weird.
It's just so odd.
So maybe Richard Bonehill didn't want to be credited? That's the only thing I can assume.
I'm going to go and watch the end credits of the film just to see if that was just a mistake on the IMDb. But yeah, there's some really good extra work in this film that we've talked about before. And this is just another great scene that, like, all the extras seem to be bringing quite a lot to their characters. And, I mean, that coughing is pretty spot on. And isn't there, like, a woman there as well, just kind of, like, you know, sitting looking really drunk and dazed? And, yeah, you do get the idea that it's a proper flop house.
And, yeah, the fact that I hadn't really clocked the Buck's cold sore, do you think that's just full-blown herpes? Is that the implication? Because it's...
I took it as that he's not very clean. He's not like a clean liver.
He's probably sampled the merchandise at least once.
And yeah, I mean, so you didn't notice the cold sore, Rob?
No, I mean, I just clearly...
Because I think the cold sore is actually credited as well because it's so massive.
I think I was distracted by the leopard print.
Which he wears well. I mean, that's a good... we can talk about the Kurgan's costume, but that is a good costume because he's got earrings and it's got the leopard skin kind of vest thing, isn't it? And it's... He looks like a well-designed character for the guy who would be running...
Oh, yeah, that's hideous.
And say, when he gets, you know, when the Kurgan grabs his arm and shoves him back against the porter boxes, that actually looks like it hurts. Like...
Yes, it's very, very believable in that way. Well, that's probably why they cast a stunt guy.
Yeah, that's possible. That's a good shout. There's like, actually, Clancy's going to have to give this guy a bit of a shove. If it's an extra, there's a whole bunch of stuff around that. Let's cast a stunt guy.
Yeah.
He was probably...
And also one who can act.
Yeah, and actually, he's not listed as, you know, a stunt actor in this film. As in, like, as far as I know, I don't think he actually did any of the sword fights, which might be, you know, which presumably is why he would have been brought on, or how he would have got involved in the discussions around Highlander. Rather than as an actor. So maybe he was just pissed off because, like, you've got some great sword fights in this. Why aren't I in any of them?
Yeah.
Well, that's really interesting because Russell Mulcahy, again, on the audio commentary, he has nothing to say about this scene, apart from the fact that he says it was shot in Earl's Court. So I think he's misremembering that. And, he says, yeah, that this guy wasn't a stunt guy. He was just an actor. And he says that when he gets shoved back into those keys, he was actually a little bit cut up by it. So he did sustain some damage from that shove. But yes, he seemed to be all right with it.
Yeah, I mean, Clancy Brown is, you know, a big guy. And Richard Bonehill, though it seems a professional athlete, is not.
No, he has a slight frame, doesn't he?
Yes. And then obviously they've got the wonderful line, you know, the Kurgan walks off and Buck's got the line, "I hope you get your head chopped off, asshole."
"I hope you get your head chopped off, asshole."
Has nobody thought that this massive guy who it seems has been spotted by Candy with a sword might be the headhunter?
Well, he does get clocked. We'll come to that in the next episode, but it's relevant to the Castigator stuff.
Yeah, because it's like, there's a giant walking around New York City. I mean, the Kurgan is not an inconspicuous man.
That's right.
No, nowhere you go. Like, not even in that hotel, he still stands out.
Yeah, it's a good point that. You got to think that Candy would say, oh, maybe, because he did have this big sword and he seemed very handy with it. So, and he wouldn't let go of it during sex. So maybe we should put a call into the police and get the reward. To which Buck would have said, we can't have the police here.
It'll screw up my business, yeah.
Although if it's a murder case, I suppose the police would overlook some of the contraband happening. But yeah.
I think they're more worried that maybe that, you know, the health inspector will get turned out. It's like, everybody's ill. There's clearly some sort of contagion.
Yeah, this place is killing more people than the headhunter, so...
It's like a fucking Cronenberg movie in here.
I also, I do like the sign that's up as well about not giving your key to someone else.
I didn't even clock that.
It's by his desk, and it's... What does it say? "Guests are not allowed to give their keys to any other tenant of the hotel or outsiders," and "out" is in red. "If found, the guests will be checked out, management." And checked out, that's a weird use of checked out, so I think it means that they'll be done a disservice or something.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah, they'll be properly thrown out.
By who? It's like, Buck's not going to do it. Who, Mr. Lucky Strike?
Yes, it will be.
I mean, like, we only ever see Mr. Lucky Strike sitting down, so it's possible when he stands up, he's actually massive. he's just been shot with, like, a perspective trick. So when he gets out of the chair, he just keeps on going up.
It's also one of those things, that's the reason why he's allowed to stay around for that situation.
And yeah, maybe that's partly why Buck yells at him and, you know, "You shut it." It's like, because you haven't done anything. You're meant to deal with these situations.
Yeah.
I how do we feel about the line? Like, I hope you get your head chopped off.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, he has just been watching the news report, or, you know, has the news report on in the background where they're apparently talking about the headhunter. So it's... I mean, that's the thing. There is, like, a killer stalking the streets of New York, decapitating people. And this is referred to multiple times. And it's clearly, you know... And when we get to the cop scene with the newspaper vendor,
yeah,
and you've got Moran saying, well, the mayor's been on the phone to me, he's breathing down my neck. It's like, this is clearly a big deal. And yet it's so completely backgrounded.
Yeah, what do you think of the line, Scott?
I don't like it. I find it's very on the nose. It's telling the... I think it's telling the audience what to think, basically. Yeah, I don't really care for it.
Fair enough. I kind of like it in terms of, it's that thing that films will do. It's the irony of it that he doesn't know that he's talking to someone who is involved in all of this and thinks that he would just be like a victim. I mean, actually, to that point, I suppose they haven't thought that it could be him, because he's saying, I hope you get your head chopped off. So he's thinking that someone else is doing it and isn't really even thinking of the Kurgan as a suspect, which is a bit weird. But
that's very true.
For me now, it's now like the equivalent of, you know, when the Terminator stays at the flop house. If there'd been a news report on people getting terminated and the Terminator walked past and somebody said to him, I hope you get terminated, asshole. It's like, there's a certain amount of irony going on. Very on-the-nose irony going on here. Yes, Scott, I completely get your point.
Yeah, it is the kind of thing that films, I mean, I think that films do it still, but films during the 80s would often have that thing like, oh, that's funny, isn't it? Because he's involved in this, but he doesn't know.
Yeah.
And it's weird that this, again, is, I mean, again, we've talked about it so much, but this opens and closes with the serial killer subplot, or references to it. Mm. A subplot that ultimately goes nowhere and doesn't really get resolved by the police. So,
I mean, they tried to resolve it a couple of times, didn't they? Just kept snipping off that particular scene. That's in the right. Few scripts and stuff.
That's right. It was, I think that there was some of it was actually shot, but the writers, I think Peter Bellwood, when he watched the final lock cut of the film, kind of had some notes for Russell Mulcahy, and one of them was the cops, what happens to the cops at the end and all this and all this stuff. But it wasn't for lack of trying on the writer's part to wrap up the subplot with the cops.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, there's something to be said for brevity in films, but there are, I do want to see a version of Highlander, a version that I know sadly doesn't exist, with all this stuff in it, and just see how, because it's possible it didn't work in terms of pacing, that it really did slow things down. And, I mean, it might be a more complete film, but would it be as interesting? Because I guess, yeah, is it funnier talking about the cop stuff having no payoff than it would be actually seeing the payoff?
That's a very good point.
Because ultimately, they're not going to arrest the Kurgan. And there could have been a way to involve them in the climax. But, yeah, it's not their story. They are incidental.
Well, I mean, the original resolution, I guess, was that Moran showed up, shot the Kurgan, and kind of, like, gave Connor the chance he needed. That, like, he fulfilled the Brenda role, I guess. And he gave Connor a chance to recover and then ultimately take Kurgan's head.
Mm.
So that would have been one way of doing it. And then, of course, you had the sort of famous fish tank scene with Bledsoe, but that got cut. The first bit got cut, so they just cut the second bit.
Yes.
Yeah. And I would like to have seen that. I would like to have seen him feeding the fish and having some friends and that kind of stuff. But
yeah.
And also, did they, Scott, do you know if they shot the scene where Rachel burns down Russell's shop come apartment?
Well, there's definitely stills of it, of her. I don't know exactly how much of the scene they shot, but there's definitely stills of her talking to Moran and, like, sort of walking off with him to go get a drink. That exists, but I don't know beyond that. Like, maybe that's just sort of publicity photography or something like that.
Yeah,
I mean, that would be an amazing alternate. I mean, I don't think it makes any sense why Rachel would burn down the shop, because it's a perfectly good shop, and, like, where's she gonna go?
Yeah, that's very true. She could just sell it.
The thing is that, like, that's prime real estate.
But it would be amazing watching a scene with just Moran and Bledsoe outside the shop that's on fire or has just been put out, and obviously Russell Nash has vanished, and then being like, well, I have no fucking idea what's going on. Like, some crimes have been committed. I couldn't tell you exactly what.
I think actually we might have stumbled onto a fetish of Connor's, because, of course, after Heather dies, he burns down the cottage. Maybe he just likes burning out. It's a bit of a, you know, there's like a pyromania to him, and he just likes to burn down his house after a certain amount of time. But yeah, the ending.
Well, probably because he got traumatized from burn him.
Oh, burn him. That's right. That's it. It all just goes back to that moment, because he was so. Yeah. So Kate, again, is just such a villain.
But again, he doesn't burn anything before he has sex with Brenda, but he does stab himself, which is obviously, you know, how his first death came about. So, yeah, burnings and stabbings.
Oh.
And you're right, he doesn't burn anything, but he scorches the screen often.
He smoulders, yes.
With that stare. Pierre has written the film, and we'll talk about it a bit later when we get towards the end of the film, but the film, as written, really did have everyone had an ending and it was all completely tied up. And you might be right, Rob, they might have thought this is just slowing it down a bit now. Yeah. And we just need to get to the end, because it is, I mean, it still comes in at just under 2 hours.
Yeah, it's, you know, what could have been, but I think what we've ended up is a pretty good film, I think we'd all agree.
Oh yeah.
It's not bad.
I prefer Highlander 3.
Oh, wow. Okay, I mean, you don't get a... We'll discuss that later, but at least you didn't say the Highlander film that does not exist.
It has been tempting to set off the alarm, but I don't know if I have anything worth setting off the alarm for.
No, they went straight from the original to Highlander 3, and it was a bold choice. In which case, is there anything left to talk about with this scene?
I like that they've sort of really made the Kurgan look... His skull is very prominent.
Mm.
Like he's really sort of... He's properly just... Especially later when he shaves his head properly, but he's really looks skull-like here.
And they've made him look a little bit ill. It's, I mean, he has the sunken eyes, his very, very pale skin, and as you said, his skull is really, really prominent through the skin. And it's like, is this just an effect of living in this flop house for a week? That you seem to have, like, even though you're immortal, you do seem to have come down with something. He doesn't look well.
Oh, no, he really doesn't.
Yeah, you know what? It's probably for the best he got out of there.
You're just very, very lucky that Yelp hasn't been invented yet.
So, yes. Mr. Daniel, is there anything else you'd like to touch upon?
No, I think I... other than the fact that Richard Bonehill sadly died in 2015, so relatively recently. But yeah, that was a shame when I found that out.
Mm. Yeah, because he wasn't particularly old, was he?
66.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yes, I thought I'd just end it on a downer. Sorry about that.
And then this, of course, is his final appearance in the film. But you know, who knows? If we decide to do Rob Roy scene by scene years down the line, that's we'll get to see a bit more of him in that.
Yeah.
Okay. In which case, Scott, thank you for coming on.
Mm-hmm. No problem.
I'm very glad to say that you're staying on for the next episode.
Yeah, absolutely.
Brilliant. If our listeners want to find you online, where can they do so?
I guess the best place would be the Highlander Archive Twitter feed, just because I think that's where I want to get the more sort of people at the moment. That's Highlander Stuff, all one word. I also, my personal Twitter feed is Scott_V_writer. To be fair, on my main one, I'm mostly a retweet machine. I retweet things I find funny in some way. Sometimes I do have observations about films and things like that. Yeah, there we go. That's my pluggable.
And yeah, well worth following both accounts. Mr. Daniel, how about yourself?
Yeah, if you want to follow me on Twitter, I'm @Rob_A_Daniel. Find my writing at filmstories.co.uk, lovehorror.co.uk, electric-shadows.com. We also do a sister podcast called The Movie Robcast, in which Rob and I talk about film more generally. And you can follow that, or listen to that, sorry, wherever you are listening to this. And you can follow it on Twitter @MovieRobcast.
Great. And if you want to follow me online, you can do so on Twitter @RobertMWallace. You can also find my writing out of all the film sites, www.ofallthefilmsites.com. If you want to follow this podcast, you can do so @MacLeodTime. And if you want to drop us an email, you can reach us at whowantstopodforever@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you, whether or not you've got a Highlander-related anecdote, if you'd like to maybe come on as a guest. Also, if you've enjoyed listening to this, or even if you haven't, please do rate and review. It's great to have the feedback, and it really does make a difference. So, again, thank you very much for listening, and until next time, all that's left to say is...
Another time, MacLeod!
That was a good eat.
Excellent.